Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on BlueChipSpeakersNava.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Danella B. She's driven down from Oakwood, Georgia, and she's a member of the Fourth Dimension Group. And I don't want to tell her story for her, but I'll tell you that she works with a lot of sponsees. She's got a sponsor, and the program is working in her life. I can see it from not too far away. I see her often up in Hall County. So, Danella, thank you for coming, and please, everybody, give her a great hand.
Hi, my name is Danella, and I'm an alcoholic. And boy, y'all fill a room at the last minute. I wasn't really nervous because it was kind of a small group. But like I said, y'all fill the room. My name is Danella, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is August 17th, 2001. And I do have a sponsor, and I have a home group. It's my second home group. I first started off in Gainesville, and I was at the hole-in-the-wall group there for many years, and then moved to the Fourth Dimension group. We meet on Friday night, so if you find your way up north, we'd love to have you up there. And when you tell your story, you're asked to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so I'm going to take the next 7 or 8 hours and tell you exactly how that happened. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous pretty early in life, mainly from the growing up in an alcoholic home. My mother is in recovery, celebrated 25 years recently, but I knew her when she was not in recovery as my mom. My dad also, from the outside, it might appear that he's got a problem with alcohol, but he doesn't think so, so we let that go for right now, and we just pray a lot for him. But I grew up with these two parents that were very young when they had me. 19 and 20 years old. I was not planned on. So I think that kind of set up some of my dysfunctions very early. Being the oldest child, I believed I was, you know, all that in a bag of chips. But I was an accident, so that dysfunctional dichotomy that some of us have where we're great, but we're not worthy of that greatness, I knew that from a very, very early age. And it was difficult. I did well in school. I've got a younger sister who didn't do as well in school. And I remember being told, like, don't talk about your grades because it might embarrass your sister. So there was always this, like, just never anything in my childhood that was just even and square and clear. And I don't share that because I think that my parents had anything to do with me being an alcoholic. I think that I was born an alcoholic, and at some point the drink found me, and I fell in love with it. But certainly the childhood, I think that you have colors, the shades of gray of your dysfunctions. And it's been important to me as I grow up, and I'm now a mom, that I look back at the lessons that I learned, and that therapy and AA has taken many, many years for me to unlearn. I try not to pass those same things on to my children. I make new and even greater mistakes sometimes with my own kids. But I started drinking at a pretty early age. When I was 12, I stole alcohol and some drugs from my mom. Started doing recreational drinking and drugging at the age of 12, completely normal. Hung out with a group that was completely normal with as well. And put myself into some pretty scary situations, ones that I hope that my daughter never has to go through, and ones that definitely colored the way that I looked at the world and how safe I felt in the world. But I continued, you know, drinking. When I took that first drink, there were four of us at a girlfriend's house. And we'd snuck up to the 7-Eleven and we'd gotten somebody to buy us 2 6-packs. And the four of us started drinking those 6-packs. Well, two of the girls lasted for a beer. Two of us kept going. And, of course, two of us, I'm grateful to say, have made it to these rooms. From the very first drink, I just wanted more. And that's the way that I drank for the next 20 years. If I started drinking, it ended when the lights came up, it ended when I was passed out, or it just didn't end. It kept going and going and going. So I drank till I was about 15. I lived with my mom, and she was kind of at the height of her addictions at that point as well. And we had a final blowout when I was 15, and they decided that maybe I was a little unruly at that point. My grades had gotten poor, and I went to go live with my dad. And at that point, my stepmom was in the picture, and she's probably the most normal thing to a parent I ever experienced. She was absolutely wonderful. She left my father after she started going to Al-Anon. So it was normal for a couple of years, and actually I found church for a really short period of time then through a group called Young Life. And I remember there was a feeling that I felt when I was there, just that maybe there was something that had filled me up. But I didn't really have anybody to talk to at that point to kind of figure out. There was already something in me that was searching for more. But again, I didn't really have people to talk to about that or kind of make it right in my own head. And so when I started hanging around with a different group in my later teens, because I didn't understand that good feeling, I went back to the good feeling that I knew before, and that was alcohol. And from about 17 on, it was on. I went to culinary school. I've been in the restaurant and hospitality business my whole life. And a lot of people in the restaurant business, you know, we drink, we play hard. You kind of get into this vampiric lifestyle, and the people that you're hanging out with, and you get off work at midnight or 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, it just seems normal. And I think that fed my drinking for a long time. When my drinking would become abnormal to the group that I was with, I just kind of found the people who did drink like me. And that was very easy to do in the restaurant business. Drank a lot. Got my first DUI at 21, was sent to meetings up in AA. I could not wait until everybody stood up and said that prayer at the end, because that meant I'd be at the bar stool within about 30 minutes. Never wanted what I heard. I could tell you exactly why I was different from that person and that person and that person, and maybe when I got that bad, I'd think about not drinking, but I could tell you all the reasons why I didn't belong there. And I went my once a week, got my piece of paper signed, and I went and got drunk after every single meeting. Miraculously, I went about 5 years before I got my next DUI. During that time, I'd gotten married and was in the middle of a divorce. Got two DUIs within 6 months. I was up in Fairfax, Virginia at the time, where the home of Mothers Against Drunk Driving is. The judges up there do not take kindly to your coming back to their courthouse within about 6 months. So at that time, I did get into some pretty serious legal trouble and financial trouble. It was starting to get a little expensive to continue drinking the way that I did, you know, taking cabs, not having a car. But that didn't stop me. Like most good alcoholics, I, you know, pretty strong willpower to get to the cocktail. And during that time, I wasn't going to tell this story, but I was reminded by a friend that it's pretty funny. During this time, you know, again, I never thought about not drinking. My mom got sober about that point, and I thought, good for her. She kept talking about these meetings and just seemed kind of obsessive about the whole recovery thing. So to me, it just looked like she'd replaced one thing with another, and I just didn't really want what she had to offer. During that time, I started dating someone, and I thought his profession was that of a drug dealer, which was an acceptable career choice at that time for me to hang out with. Turns out he'd actually robbed 4 banks in Northern Virginia over about a two-week period and used my car for two of them. So we do have, that's why I try not to make too big of a secret of the fact that I'm in recovery and in AA, because on the Washington Post magazine, or Washington Post newspaper, there's a couple of front page articles with me at my best. So if I can be that public about my addictions and choices, I try to give equal opportunity to better choices that I've made since then. But I do have a hard time watching the show America's Most Wanted when you're picked up by six officers and thrown down on your face, and what you hear is chick, while there's helicopters in the air and dogs running around. It's a little nerve-wracking when I hear that or see that on TV. So I was briefly on Virginia's Most Wanted list. And apparently when you go to jail for that, you have some automatic street creds. But I was terrified, absolutely terrified. Believe it or not, I didn't get into very much trouble over that. Got a good lawyer because my car had been at the scene, but I had not, thank God. I actually didn't get into a lot of trouble. And I stayed good for a couple of years. I stayed away from drugs. I continued drinking, kind of got my life together, got into another relationship. You know, and my history when I started looking at it when I got sober was I'd be in this really good, stable relationship with, you know, somebody that I actually wanted to do better for. And when that would end because of my drinking and because of my chaos, as it usually did, then I would get into a really, really self-destructive and really detrimental relationship. And so, I mean, I just, you can't see it when you're in it, but thank God for working the steps and actually doing timelines and get to change patterns like that. So in 2000, I was working in a restaurant, just a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs. I'd kind of changed friends and playmates again, and I got my last DUI on St. Patty's Day in 2001. And at this point, there really wasn't any more running from the law, running, you know, I couldn't make it okay this time. The judges were really just fed up with me. I didn't have a license at that point. It fell right in between when I could have been a felony DUI. I had 4.5 DUIs at that point. The half is because I refused once based on the officer who told me that I was just better off not blowing and not getting the DUI, but taking a reckless or whatever, the refusal. So I was really looking at trouble at that point. The relationships had gone downhill. My finances had really gone downhill by this point. That last DUI, in order for an attorney to even talk to me about my case, I had to come up with $15,000. I had to sell my vehicle. I sold jewelry. I pawned my first wedding ring. I mean, all this just to give an attorney to even talk to me about my case at that point. The judges were talking about putting me in jail for 6 months to a year. You know, I mean, just as, you know, happens with many of us, the consequences were just getting to the point where they were mounting up and mounting up. And when you keep making the same mistake, the same solution doesn't always work. And so that summer, I was scheduled to go to court early in the summer, and I somehow convinced everybody that I should stay up in Virginia and postpone my case until the end of August, which was when my lease was up. And I came down here to visit once, and we had this grand plan that when my lease was up, I would go to court, I would handle whatever it was the judge gave me, and then I would move down here to Georgia, where my mother was. My mom had time in sobriety at that point. My sister had moved down here about 6 years before that, also had time in sobriety. So I would be moving down where I had family that could support this new way of life, this new way of life that I still didn't want, didn't think I belonged to, didn't think I needed, but it sounded really good on paper that this was my plan. And I remember coming down here early that summer. My niece was in a play. And we met with the then director of Laurelwood to talk about this plan of my coming down here and going to Laurelwood. And he looked at me as I described my plan, and he said, I don't think you're going to live that long. And I was so mad that he would have the nerve to say that to me. I mean, did he not just hear? You know, I had a plan. I was going to come down here at the end of the summer. I was going to go to Laurelwood and whatever that entailed. And then I'd be good for a while. And then I might move back to Virginia or, you know, who knows what I would do. But I would get all this off my back. Well, I went up to Virginia, and my attorney said, I think you need to start going to AA meetings before you go to court. So I started going to meetings up there, and for the first time, what people were saying, I couldn't ignore. But instead of me wanting it, what it did was it made me want to run so badly, because I was terrified of who or what I would be if you took alcohol away from me. It was such a big part of who and what I was, and the restaurant business, and I just thought it was everything, and I would be nothing without it. So I got to the point in early August where in order to go to those meetings, I'd have to stop and take a drink on my way. And I now know that those people up in Virginia, when they would smile at me, and I thought I was fooling them, when they would smile at me and say, keep coming back, I now know what they meant by that. And I now know that every time that they said that to me, they honestly meant it. On August 17th, I was packing my house to move down to Virginia. And again, I was so uncomfortable with what was going to happen next, and I didn't know what the judges were going to do. So I had this whole plan. I'm a little bit of a control freak, as you might have picked up already. I had this whole plan, and I was packing my things for what if the judge puts me away for 6 months? Well, what if he only puts me away for a week? What if I have to pack everything into a suitcase to move to Georgia? And I sat there in my just confusion and chaos, not knowing how to pack up my life for this trip to Georgia. How long was it going to be for? Was I going to have everything that I needed? I had little color-coded things that I was putting on suitcases and on bags and on brushes. And it was just more than I could handle. And I had that moment where I realized I didn't know how to live life. And I could not see myself continuing on any longer. And so I sat at my dining room table and I started writing notes to my family. And I apologized to them for not being able to do this. And I apologized to them that I hadn't figured out how to live life. And I wished them all well. I swallowed a full bottle of Tylenol PM at that time, and I remember the first handful. And it was absolutely right. There was not a doubt in my mind that I was making the right decision, because I could not see that there was anything on the other side for me. And I am so grateful that God saved me from myself. A girlfriend of mine called me, and by this time I'd been going since the night before, and she called me somewhere in the middle of that first handful and the last handful. And it was a really odd time of the day for me to be that messed up. It was mid-afternoon by then. And I didn't tell her what I was doing, and I didn't tell her goodbye. She said it was a real quick conversation. But she got off the phone, and she said it was as if somebody walked up behind her at her desk and said very clearly, you can't get to her in time. And she called the police. Which if I'd not been doing what I was doing, I would have been really, really irritated for a friend of mine to send the cops to my house. The cops showed up. I was passed out on my bathroom floor. And they took me to the hospital. And I came to 3 days later, filled with charcoal and all sorts of other ugly, nasty stuff. My family was all around me. The cops had been through my house. My parents had been through my house. The cat was out of the bag. There weren't many secrets at that point. The officers pretty much told me that if I didn't go to treatment, if I didn't go to court, and if I didn't go on my plan to move to Georgia, they would use me to get to other people in the Fairfax area, because of the drugs and so forth. And so it seemed like a wise idea to listen to them. And I remember the first night in the hospital, they kept me there for about a week. apparently your body doesn't like those things, and it takes about a week for the half-life of all of that to get to the point where they're not worried about your liver shutting down. But I was there by myself in the hospital, and everyone had gone, and my family was packing up. And I remember just looking up and going, I'm done. I am absolutely done. And it was angry. And I knew there was a God listening to me, but I was mad. And I said, I don't know what the bleepity, bleepity, bleepity I'm supposed to do, because my plans, I'm done. I hope you've got something, and I better see it now. Little did I know that that was just a very, very angry first, second, and third step. And I went to treatment, and I spent about 28 days up in Virginia. My court case did come up during that time, and on September 10th, 2001, I got locked up. And I am so grateful that that judge put me in jail for that week, because on September 11th, 2001, I woke up in jail with eight other women about 15 miles away from the Pentagon, and I watched those planes hit the tower. Now, if I could get drunk over all the reasons that I got drunk for prior, at 17 days sober, there was no way I think I would have stayed sober through that. I was in a very safe place, and I was with some other women. There was another woman in jail with me who also had had some exposure to the program, who gave me a little wooden cross, and we said the Serenity Prayer together. And when I got out, I went to meetings, and I went to meetings with people. I remember a gentleman who'd lost his entire office. He worked at the Pentagon. His entire office and people that he'd worked with were gone. And I, for the first time, I watched people living their life through good times and through bad times, and they were doing it sober. And I remember picking up some hope from that, that maybe there was an opportunity for me to start living a sober life. And I moved down here to Georgia, and I threw myself into AA. And I am so grateful for the people up in Gainesville. We've got some strong recovery in Gainesville. And I remember the women that just wrapped themselves around me and introduced themselves to me. I moved down here without a license. It took me 3.5 years to get my driver's license back. And sometimes I miss that 3.5 years because it taught me a lot of humility, and it taught me a lot about friendships. Because I would have to ask people for rides. I spent time with people before and after meetings. And most of those friendships that were forged in that 10, 15 minutes before and after meetings are still the women that I call on today and the women that I'm closest with. So I'm very grateful. Looking back, God has always known to not give me more than I needed, not give me more than I could handle, but give me enough so that I would have hope to take that next step. And I did get a sponsor fairly early on. My mom at that point had 14 years sober. And she said, you know, I think it's going to be important. I've been here in Gainesville. You might have some issues with me. And it might be a good idea to find somebody that I'm not friends with. That was great advice because it made me really look outside and start listening to people. And I wanted somebody who had been sober for a while, you know, who had really developed this as a lifestyle, and it was important to them as they went through life. And I'm so grateful. There was a woman who had moved to Gainesville from here in Atlanta. She and her husband about 3 months before. And I was sitting at a meeting. It was a midnight meeting at the Halt Club. And so it was dark and candlelight. And I remember at the end of the meeting, when they were passing out chips, there was a woman who got up to get a 25-year chip. And when she spoke about the fact that she and her husband had nearly 25 years down here in Atlanta, and they'd moved up to Gainesville. And when they did, they decided to be the newcomer in the area, and they'd gone to 90 meetings in 90 days, and they were redoing the steps with their sponsor. And I got chills, just like I do now whenever I think about that moment, because in that moment I said, that's what I want. I want this so badly that I want to be on fire for it in 25 years, just like that. And so we went for coffee, and I'm so grateful that Joan M. is still my sponsor. She very, very lovingly took me through the steps the first time. I had quite the... came in with, you know, by the time I saw and I started doing that first step, I really got washed with a lot of shame and a lot of guilt and a lot of, God, I just should have known better. Like, how was this okay with you? You know, when I started writing down the decisions that I made that hurt other people, and I started working on my fourth step and just really getting the full picture of my life and what I had done to other people and what I had done to myself, I remember just feeling really guilty that I had never seen it before then. And very lovingly, I remember her telling me, you know, don't beat yourself up for not seeing it before you saw it. Now that it's been seen, it will never be unseen, and it's what you do with it from here on out that really matters. And I'm so grateful. You know, sometimes you hear stories about sponsors that really kind of crack a whip on people and really push them. And I'm so grateful that she was just exactly the kind of sponsor that I needed at that time, who very lovingly got me to a place where I was a little more comfortable with myself. I'd mentioned that early in high school, I kind of felt a connection a little bit to God, but I didn't know what to do with it. There was a feeling, but I didn't really know what it meant. Over the next 10 years or so of my drinking, I remember talking about just this very intellectual God, you know, a lot of judgment. And so when I got here, I remember thinking that, you know, I don't understand this personal relationship that people talk about. God was still very far away. I knew that there had been something miraculous that had happened that night, that I didn't die, but it wasn't personal. And I would listen to people. I'd get really uncomfortable when people would talk about God in meetings and, you know, almost like clenching up the shoulders and waiting for, you know, that bolt of lightning or the other shoe to drop. And I remember when we started, we'd worked through the first three steps. And when I got to step three, like I said, I knew that there was something bigger than me. And I knew that there was a group of drunks that were bigger than me that could help me stay sober. When I went through steps four and steps five and shared with her and was starting to feel a little bit more comfortable, and we were getting into six and seven and admitting those defects and trying to clear away some of the wreckage as I stepped into eight and to nine, I remember one day having this really clear feeling when we were saying the Lord's Prayer about that forgiveness. And I realized that there was a lot that I was not forgiving myself for. I realized there was a lot that I wasn't forgiving my childhood for, and that I really needed to practice that with the people in my life. And my relationship started to change with my family around me, with my friends. And as those relationships on this world started to change, I could feel that the relationship that I had with God started to change as well. And I just wasn't as uncomfortable with the feeling that there was a God who loved me for all my imperfections. And many times I think loves me because of my imperfections, because I know what they are today. And I don't think that working the steps gets us closer to perfect, but I think it allows us to see ourselves so clearly, and it allows us to see what we need to continue to work on. And we're given the opportunity to do that. And we're given the opportunity to do that in our relationships that we have here today. So where we're selfish, we can learn to be unselfish. And where we're thinking only of ourselves, we can think of other people first. And I looked back at some of the wrongs that I had done to other people. And I remember thinking and talking to my sponsor and saying, you know, I don't know how to do these amends, because very few of my amends were because I had taken money from somebody, or, you know, kind of those clear cut, you take $300 from somebody, you owe that person $300. You steal their car, you owe them a car back. A lot of mine were about time. They were about the way I had treated people. During those years of managing restaurants, I had, you know, dozens of employees that I just treated horribly. You know, employees that I fired, that I took away their livelihood without a second thought because I could or because that was how I felt in the moment. And I didn't know how to make up for some of that. And I'm grateful that, you know, my sponsor helped me work through some of that, that I needed to be open to those opportunities to make those direct amends. But what I needed to do was not make those same mistakes and not treat people the same way. And so I started making those indirect amends with the people around me. But whenever I've ever doubted that I was on the right path, I've definitely gotten signs and some pretty amazing things have happened to let me know I'm on the right path. When I was going through those amends, and I'd written my 8-step list, and we were looking at what I should do first, I was managing a store in the Gainesville area, and I had to call our sister store up in Dahlonega. And one day I dialed the number for our sister store in Dahlonega, and a strange voice answered the phone. And I said, "John?" And he said, "Yes," because John was the name of the manager in Dahlonega. But lo and behold, the person who was on the phone was a man by the name of John, who lives up in Virginia. John had put me through a training course for me to go teach his restaurant employees, ironically, how to, tips, training and intervention procedures for servers of alcohol. I was a tips certified trainer, which is ironic, but he put me through this class in order to teach this course to his bartenders and servers, and you get a reduction in your liquor liability. Well, he had put me through this class at the beginning of the summer, and at the end of the summer, I was down here and had never done the work for him that he paid for. So he was on my list of somebody that I owed money to. When I called the store in Dahlonega, the area code for Dahlonega is 706. The area code for Virginia is 703. It was the exact same phone number with a different area code. Now, I don't know what statistically the odds are of misdialing one number and dialing somebody who's on your amends list, but I'm assuming that that number is pretty small. So when John answered the phone, and I knew it was him because he had a Boston accent, he said, you know, "Hey, Red, how the hell are you?" And I went, I'm okay. I'm in Georgia. Funny you should answer the phone. I'm not really sure how I got a hold of you, but I owe you some money." And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I said, "You know, you put me through this class, and I didn't do it, and I'm down here in Georgia, and I'm trying to make things right, and I don't have $400 right now, but I have $50, and I'd like to send it to you, and could I do a payment plan?" And he said, "You know, I'm just happy to hear that you're alive. We almost lost you. Keep doing what you're doing." But I did send him $50 a month for the next several months, and I knew that this program worked once again. And as I continued on, and you know, the next steps are about living this program. I was in a relationship early in my sobriety, which I thought would be, you know, boy meets girl in AA room and they fall madly in love, and you know, the statistics don't happen to them, and you know, that would be the end all and be all relationship. Well, it wasn't, and it ended after a couple of years. And I remember going through and having to walk through true grief the first time in sobriety. And I was seeing a therapist at the time as well. And I remember just feeling overcome by these feelings at times. And I went into meetings and I cried, and I have friends who saw me go into meetings and cry, because you all said if I walked into the meeting with more than I could handle, you all would take a little bit of it with you, and when I walked out, I wouldn't have too much. So I tested that repeatedly up in Gainesville, and I went to meetings, and I just was overcome with grief. And I remember one thing my therapist said to me that just made such sense. He said, "Danella, your entire adult life, you have never walked through to the other side of grief. You've always stopped whenever you could get to a bottle." This is the very first time as a sober person you have the opportunity to walk to the other side of these emotions. And this is bigger than what this situation is, because this is every death that you've not dealt with. This is every other relationship breaking up, every other hurt, every other abandonment. But he said, I promise you, if you walk through this time, and you don't stop and pick up a drink, it'll never be this big again. And I'm so grateful that I had people who just, you know, loved me while I sniveled in meetings and couldn't read how it works without breaking into tears, and then watched me come out of the other side of that. And to this day, I mean, I've had ups and downs, and I met my husband, also in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's sitting right there. Very grateful that we met 8 years ago, and all of those plans and dreams that I had from a bar stool, talking about kids and talking about trips that I wanted to take and talking about a life that I wanted to live. I'm so grateful that I get to live it today with my best friend and my partner. He's got a little bit more time than me, which I appreciate, and his experience has been very different, and I appreciate that as well. Together, I think we make a pretty good pair, and what he said to me when he asked me to marry him was that the lumps in his head match the holes in my head, and we might make a pretty good pair. And so far, that's been the case. And pretty soon after we got married, I was pregnant, and we've got two beautiful children, Emma, who's now 7, JB, who's 5. And I'm so grateful that I have two children who've never seen their parents drunk, who've never wondered if their parents were going to come home, who've never wondered what mood, or, you know, if there was going to be a glass thrown against a wall or a fist across their face. I've got two kids that absolutely know that they're loved, and I've got two kids that love to go to the Friday night nine-night meeting, where they don't quite know why mommy and daddy are there, but they do know that we're allergic to alcohol. And as time goes on, I'm sure that, you know, they'll have questions and they'll wonder, you know, why do mommy and daddy have a problem with alcohol? Because they don't drink. And I know, because of friends in the program, I know that I'll know what to say when that day comes. Because that's how I've learned to live a life as a sober woman, as a sober wife, as a sober mother, as a sober boss, as a sober friend. It's been because of women that I've met in these rooms that have shared with me how they did it. And sometimes by their grace, I learn how to do it well. And sometimes by their stumbles, I learn how to do it not so well. And by my own stumbles, they teach me how to do it better the next time. And I'm so very grateful for the life that I have today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, you know, there's sometimes I wonder, you know, would life have been different if at 21 I'd walked into that room and I was ready? I'm sure it would have been different. But I also know from my experience that you're never actually late to an AA meeting. It's just that first one. You get here exactly when you're supposed to, and your seat is waiting for you. And I think it's a couple of minutes early, but I think I've gotten to, you know, this place where I'm at today, where I've looked back on this last week, as I knew this was coming up tonight, and wondering, you know, what is the message that I think that I'm supposed to share? And I think one of the nicest things that I've heard, and I say this sometimes when I tell my story, is that, you know, if you need a seat in this room and you never sit in it, the end of the story is already written. It says in our big book, Jails, Institutions, and Death. But the most beautiful thing is that if you need to be in these rooms and you find your seat, the end of your story is unwritten. And that's the experience that I'm having today. I have a beautiful life and a beautiful family, and I have a sponsor, and I do have sponsees, and it's a wonderful, wonderful life. And if you're here for the first time, I hope that you've heard something that says that you'd like to come back. But more importantly, if you're sitting here thinking this might be the last time you're sitting in a meeting. I may not have said what you need to hear, so please grab somebody, because I do guarantee you that there's somebody in this room that understands exactly what you're feeling and has been there, and will walk through that with you if you'll just ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Janelle. What did I tell you? Anybody going to take a drink tonight? No way, eh?
The journey. Every part of our life is a journey. We journey from spirit to flesh to spirit. We journey through life and the different stages of life. We step off of the path. We get lost. We find the path. All is part of the journey. A journey within the journey. And all the while, we are never lost, though we have the experience of being lost. We have the experience of being back on the path, though it is impossible to step off of the path. For we are on a journey within the journey. So every step we take is a step on the path, and the step itself is a journey. Everything is plain to see, and everything is mystical and impossible to see. It is all part of the journey, or the journey within the journey.
Looking back on yesterday, trying to find a better way to go. But I don't know. The road that brought me had a lot of turns along the way. But that's okay. When you feel like a traveler at the station, searching for some unknown destination, just remember the living's in the learning, and it's not a destination, it's a journey. Wasted so much time trying to find a place you just can't go. Now I know it doesn't matter anyhow. The place you're looking for is right now, here and now. When you feel like a traveler at the station, searching for some unknown destination, just remember the living's in the learning, and it's not a destination, it's a journey. It's not a destination, it's a journey.